Welcome back to Tasteland. I am Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking with today?
Today we're speaking with Elliot Aronow. He's the host slash producer of Minor Genius, a culture imprint that publishes zines, hosts parties, and occasionally produces very handsome neckties. Inside that, there's also a very discreet private studio where he works as an editor and co-conspirator with visible weirdos to ship finished artifacts. As a visible weirdo, I'm very excited to learn what that means.
Visible weirdo, huh?
It's if you're going to do that, you better have a joke lined up. Let me tell you, that's going straight to the blooper reel.
No, I'm not. So before we talk to Elliot, thing I read yesterday that's, you know, the article of the last 24 hours that might be irrelevant already by the time this comes out, but I don't think it will. It was fun. Was the Atlantic, McKay Coppins, he's the writer, the Atlantic gave him $10,000 to bet with. And like the reason they gave him $10,000 is he's Mormon, practicing Mormon, who would go against his religious principles to bet. But apparently it's okay. It's a little loophole if it's just money his work gives him and he's only using this. It's a long article. I read it before bed last night. I don't know how long it took me to read, but like the thing, they've got like the audio version at the top of the page, and that's like an hour and 10 minutes long. So it's a long read. But I just want to recommend it. Have you read it yet?
No. I was thinking we should have David Hill back on the podcast talk about it with him.
This very same man was on my mind.
I saw a little bit of reaction from him. I mean, I didn't form an opinion. What was the general sentiment that you saw?
So what my impression of the article myself was, this is great. I mean, I broadly think that sports gambling, the proliferation of gambling apps on phones is bad. I'm personally down probably like, I think I've bet, if you go into my FanDuel account, it's probably like $700 I've bet lifetime, and I'm probably down 100. It could be worse, but I thought it was a great read, and I like broadly agree with his sentiment that like it's bad that gambling apps are on phones. What was more funny was logging on to the X app in my browser this morning and seeing professional gamblers, people who are in that world, just totally dragging this article. Like this one guy said, I'm going to read this tweet. He didn't lose 10K. You gave him a free 10K bankroll and told him he's not personally responsible for any issues. He's also ultra religious, Mormon, and knew nothing about sports betting or gambling in general before this, and I quote, assignment. At best, this was a poor representation of the sports betting experience by the general population. At worst, this was an experiment done in bad faith to try to paint the sports betting world in a bad light. So that's what's been really interesting to me is people who are deep in sports bet land really just dragging this article. It's like, to me, it kind of proves the point.
I mean, my takeaway is that sports gambling is in the same category as soaking for Mormons, where if like somebody else is intervening, it's actually allowed.
I mean, I'm not going to laugh because I think that's completely correct here.
You already laughed, so game
that's
over.
Just my that's just my
you were nervous
affect.
Yeah. You were nervous that soaking came up on Tasteland. This is what like our 69 is this our 69th episode?
No, Daisy, that's so immature. It's our like 85th or something like that.
All right, my bad.
Nervous. Let's talk to
well, anyway. Send all Elliot right. in.
Send him in. Send in the troops. What is Minor Genius? What does that mean?
Do you want the what is it part first?
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So Minor Genius is a imprint where we put out zines and throw parties and produce artifacts. So physical things that can be mailed and kicked and hung up and passed around. And then that's kind of the polo version of the company. And then inside that, there's a very discreet one-on-one studio where I work with kind of like public weirdos to ship stuff like, you know, short films, magazines, fashion lines, which I guess if we're doing the Ralph metaphor is like more purple label. So elite, sharp, expensive.
You're a big Ralph guy. As I was prepping for this, I noticed that the name comes up a lot wherever you show up.
I'm hooked. I mean, I'm probably mangling the theory, but I think it was maybe Marx. I'm going to look really dumb if I don't get this right. But like basically this idea that objects are imbued with magic. I really feel like Ralph is the greatest to ever imbue objects with magic. And like when I go in the store, no matter what year it is, like I want everything.
What is your first memory of a zine? Like, do you remember the first time you encountered that type of object?
Yes, I do. So I'm not sure if this counts as a zine because I did buy it at Barnes & Noble, but I bought an issue of Maximum Rock and Roll in 1995. And just the fact that it was newsprinty and smudgy and was filled with things that I didn't understand was really exciting for me at the time. Because like, I think at this point I'm 15. So like, I'm not really in like the punk scene yet because no one I know drives. So I would say that was probably like the first mass market zine. And then when I was like 17, I started getting more into like zines like Comet Bus and stuff like that. But yeah, I was a teenager.
Now, when was your first encounter with Ralph Lauren?
Okay, well, I can tell you my first encounter with not Ralph Lauren because that might explain why I like him so much.
Okay, I love this. We're going to back into it.
Yeah, so I remember distinctly wanting the Ralph polo shirt, but my parents at the time were like, this is really like a lot of money, so we'll get you something that kind of looks similar. So I went to JCPenney and I got a Hunt Club.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the GoBots version of what should be Transformers. Like it just kind of carries this like quiet sadness of like not the real thing. So that was like the contrast of Ralph. And then in terms of actual Ralph, there was a store near me called Vintage Image. And I bought a blue short sleeve polo shirt with very faint white and red stripes. And I remember at the time that I thought that it signaled being alternative. And I couldn't really place why, but it occurred to me a couple of years ago that I thought it looked like the shirt that Kurt Cobain wears in the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, which is a black shirt with white and green and white stripes. So for some reason, I just associated like striped PK cotton with being alternative. But yeah, that was my first, I would say like Ralph shirt with my ownish money.
I was just going to say like in this time period, you were like punk curious and you were looking at these alternative media sources, but you were also gravitating towards the Ralph polo. You wanted the real thing. Were those contradictions to you at the time, or were these both sort of subversive in your mind as like a teenager?
Yeah, I think like, so I was born in Staten Island, which probably explains a lot about how I turned out, but I was born in Staten Island and my family moved to New Jersey in 1991 and I had to go with them. And I experienced a lot of class anxiety because in Staten Island, most people work for the city. It's like, as you may or may not know, it's like teachers, firefighters, cops. My parents are both teachers, so that explains that. But in New Jersey, I kind of had like just this felt sense that my parents did not have as rich people professions as those around me. And so clothing became a really, really important way for me to try and protect myself and show that I was down. I really love the texture of your question because this is something that I struggled with a lot where I've always just liked nice things. And I've always identified with underground culture. And a lot of people like at the time sort of didn't know where to place me because I wasn't like a punk kid that wore like dirty sweatshirts with like things stapled to them or whatever. And so I was sort of this like person without a country because I obviously didn't like get down with the popular kids, but I did kind of like the way they dressed. I thought it looked good.
Yeah. This way. So I think a lot about legibility on the internet, right? And, you know, advice for like building a personal brand or like building any kind of brand online is often mm-hmm. like make it legible. People should be able to like understand what it is and express mm-hmm. what it is back to you. Right. Yeah. But the like kind of what you're describing is this tension. And even now, like looking at any of your surfaces on the internet, you are very specific and particular. And even now I hear you like saying some of the notes that you tend to express on all your platforms, like style is protection, right? This is one of your things. And so I'm struck that like what you're explaining with this like tension between polo and punk zines and what we're talking about now is like, it's very legible, but like what's legible is also like a bit of an illegibility, a bit of like, it's not one thing, it's multiple things. And it like refuses to be two things. Yeah, I'm interested in that as a brand, like legible, but like contrasting.
Well, I think for me, legibility is felt more than understood. Mm. And I think with Minor Genius, it's kind of like intentionally self-selecting in that if you like the font or the zines or you like being around other people who will probably compliment your loafers, then they're all, everybody is welcome, but we don't really change like the texture or the shape of what we do and how we do it to like accommodate it. I guess like to use a sort of, I don't know, more easy metaphor. It's like the door is always open, but we're not going to rearrange the furniture in the room so that you feel more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, that relates to a Substack post from August that Francis and I were looking at called Our Legacy Panic, What Happens When You Outgrow Your Audience.
Yeah.
And you're sort of talking about people who are public facing, who have built up an audience of the wrong people. Like at some point there's a flip in the dynamic between this person and their audience where the audience starts to accrue some resentment towards the platform mm-hmm. that you've created, that maybe you've outgrown them or more people have come in. I saw this when I worked at Hodinkee, which is for people that don't know, it's like a watch magazine and it was a watch retailer for a bit. Then it went back to being just a magazine. There was a core audience of watch nerds, like self-professed watch nerds, that Ben Clymer, you know, they were the core reader of Ben Clymer. They created, you know, the initial buzz around his writing about watches. And then as the brand grew, in order to like sustain that growth, they had to reach people who were kind of just like casual watch enthusiasts mm-hmm. Or somebody who like never really paid attention to watches and then, you know, made their first big paycheck and just went straight to the Rolex store and sort of were retroactively trying to learn about things. So there's like a ton of tension there. Mm-hmm. And I would love to know more about how you observed this phenomenon that you were writing about. Like, did this mm-hmm. happen to you? And like, how do you coach people to prevent this from happening to them?
Well, I don't do any coaching, so I'm not sure that I can help people like directly in terms mm-hmm. of advice, but the Beastie Boys and Nirvana were both really big deals for me as a kid. And just to give like a little music lore right now, you know, the Beastie Boys famously had this reputation after License to Ill for being these like idiot jock, you know, like sexist, stupid people. And they sort of went out of their way with Paul's Boutique to like kill that version of themselves. Of course, Nirvana and Kurt Cobain very famously like kind of was this guy who grew up and said, man, like the kids that used to beat me up, like now they come to my shows and they wear band t-shirts. So I think, again, just when you're living in a time, you can't help but absorb like what's in the air in the arts and in culture. So I think very early, there was just this like early warning system of, hey, just do this with a certain focus and particularity, because the last thing that you would want is to get big as like a caricature of yourself. Mm. And I think now, you know, like, I have a lot of friends that make money, showing up regularly on the internet and interpreting things and talking and being visible. And I think a part of me like always wanted that, but then the other part was kind of like unwilling to contort myself into that, to use your word, Francis, that legible shape too soon, you know? Yeah. So I think that's kind of it. And I think a lot of folks struggle with that, is like you want to express, you want to be in the mix, you want to be in the culture, but there's a lot of invisible costs that go along with that, that I think just need to be a little bit considered.
This reminded me of something just really quick. This, like what you just said about like not wanting to make yourself too legible too soon. I might've brought this up on here before, but like I think about it all the time. There's this book I read in college, this cultural anthropology class called Number Our Days, Culture and Community Among Elderly Jews in an American Ghetto. And it takes place, it's like the writer, Jewish anthropologist, she wanted to go study aging. She was going to go do it in Mexico. But she goes and they're kind of like, why don't you study your own people? And she's like, oh shit. Like, why don't I study my own people? So she goes to this retirement home, and Barbara Meyerhoff, that's the author. But there's this line they'll never forget where she's talking to this guy, this older gentleman, it's like 1960s or 70s. And he says like, I don't want you to write about me. Like, I don't want to have like a pin stuck in me, because then I feel like I can't roll, because like, and then if anybody reads this about me, then they'll have this certain definition of me and I won't be able to shake it. Like once you put a pin in me, I can't roll. Which we don't need to keep reading into that, but I just love that idea. And I think about it every like month.
Yeah. Well, I think, the stuff that I've always loved and organized my life around, both professionally and creatively, it's moved through culture in like weirder and more unexpected ways. Like all the stuff that I think I'm attracted to and what I like in other people's work is a sort of rejection of like literalism, to maybe bring it back to like the punk, the preppy punk tension. Is like, you know, rejecting jock culture like fully, like with every millimeter of my being, but also being like, oh man, I really love the way that Oxford looks. Like the collar roll is just so good. And like, what an amazing shade of yellow, you know, not quite daffodil, not quite pastel, but just, you know, like, so it's, I sort of like things that are, I don't know, instead of like either or, it's like neither both.
Yeah.
You have been organizing this reading series at Nightclub 101 where you're specifically seeking out people that haven't read in public before. Yeah. And that feels related to this a little bit as well, the way that we define ourselves in public, the way that we write about ourselves or allow others to write about us. Can you explain a little bit, like, can you explain the genesis of that project?
Yeah, well, you know, I think like a lot of people, my friends and I were really let down by the last 4 or 5 years, just on so many levels. And I think it's very hard to live in New York if you don't have high hopes. And so the people that I was talking to about doing these events or potentially participating, we were kind of just like, why don't we be the thing that we wish existed? And instead of doing what everyone else does and what we're prone to do, which is like complaining about it and criticizing, you know, like all these people that we think are lame, let's just create our own little autonomous city state for a couple hours And maybe to bring it back to the very first question about, you know, Minor Genius or kind of like the ethos behind it, you know, I think that you don't need to be like a vetted professional to earn the right to have a voice in the culture. You don't need someone to say that you're good to be a musician. You don't need to, you know, have the style industry co-sign your work and decide that you're an influencer. Mm-hmm. And so I love the idea of getting people who had an appetite to read, but probably would have felt very alienated by a traditional serious literary reading, you know, and that's why we do it at Nightclub 101 and we don't do it at like McNally.
Yeah.
Is there a particular moment that has come out of the series where you were like, this is like exactly the ethos that I'm trying to cultivate here?
Yeah. I think when people came back for the second one and I didn't know like three quarters of the people in the room, that's sort of when I knew it was clicking.
Yeah.
You know, you can point to little moments, of course, where someone said a killer line or, you know, like the door creaked in this weird way and like everyone sort of knew it was ruining the moment, but was also perfect. There's, of course, all that stuff when you're throwing events and working with like a live room. But this woman came up to me afterwards. I was selling my zines at the merch table and she just said what I thought was like the best thing ever, which was, the coolest person in my office went to the first one and told me that I had to come and check out this one.
That's so cool.
So I was like, man, like if the coolest person in your office is resonating with this and so much so that you decided to like leave the house on a Thursday, walk to the middle of Avenue A, which, you know, it's the furthest away from any train. 7th Street. So, I mean, you're really like, you're making a big commitment. It's not like, you know, 2nd and 1st, fine. You know, it's only a block away from the F, but this is like, this is you went all the way to the middle to come and be a part of this.
So one thing I know that when we were emailing, you wanted to talk about scenes versus audiences. Like this to me feels like an example of that. Like an audience is the people who showed up for the first one, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then a scene is like, it spreading and then you not knowing people's talk more about this scene versus audience.
Yeah. I think to me, audience is more consumptive and passive and scene is more messy and there's higher voltage and more personalities. And I think that seeing the same weird people over and over again is a very, very successful formula for life. Is what I loved about the punk scene coming up is same people for better or worse, but like that, but, the same people over and over again, I think creates a certain harmony in the nervous system and in the social fabric that I think is really special. I get this at jiu-jitsu. I see the same people four times a week. And there's just that feeling of like, oh yeah, like we all chose to be here. Also, I think of audiences as these sort of, separated people on phones doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think of a scene as, hey, I met you at this party. I found out that you're a photographer. Guess what? I actually need to shoot this thing next week. Like there's been a lot of pollination at all these Minor Genius events where people have found their next sound engineer, the next writer for their magazine who was looking for a story. There's probably some romantic rendezvous that I'm not privy to, but to me, that's the biggest difference is, a scene requires effort and energy and inconvenience. Whereas I think an audience, it doesn't ask any of those things. So I think the return is like a little bit more like warm Pepsi.
How did you get into jiu-jitsu? Like you moved to New Jersey. Did this happen when you were you were still young, or is this an adult hobby?
This is like I started when I was 42. So this is three years ago.
Okay. It's a midlife journey.
Midlife journey.
Very quickly. I was working with someone and said, Els, you're a very sensitive, emotionally literate person. I think you should do something that like goes against all that and is like very aggressive and physical and just sort of like rowdy. And so I asked my friends, I said, what is the best jiu-jitsu studio in New York? And all of them said, you got to go to Clockwork Jiu-Jitsu on Broadway. It's like all the punks and all the fashion people and all the weirdos go there. You're going to love it. And I caught the bug, I also just think it's very rare to get a place where you can just fail over and over again. And I mean, I'm 3 years into this and I've probably gone from like excruciatingly, bleedingly terrible to like maybe just like very terrible. And that's in 3 years. Like I went like a decimal point over towards like not being that bad.
Would you say you're doing purple label jiu-jitsu now?
I mean, my own jiu-jitsu personally, I would have to say is probably more chaps.
That's okay.
It's definitely the budget. Like you're just getting going. And in fact, I mean, I resist wearing the really ornate, like awesome gis because I don't feel like I've earned it. Like I wear very basic, like just black and white, like, okay, because the gis are really coming out hot these days. You know, I think that there's like become this almost like streetwearish mentality. Mm-hmm. There's a brand called Show Your Roll, Shoyorol. That's become very, very coveted on the secondary market. Mm-hmm. Which is a little disturbing when you think about like the idea of wearing a secondhand gi.
Yeah.
but hey, it's imbued with that capitalist magic.
Before we get off the scene topic, Daisy, I want to ask you a question. Okay. The Dirt Books, you did a lot of press for Dirt Books this week. One of the books, there's two books that you are launching with. One of them is a scene book. Can you talk about this for a second?
Yeah, well, the word scene is in the title because the book was published, the first side of the book, which we're calling it Side A, was self-published under the title Tattooed, Pierced, and Fucked Up. But all of the stuff that's being added to Side A and some of the stuff inside Side A is really anthropology of the Warped Tour era of a certain style of music. And we wanted a way to indicate to people that were coming to it fresh that this isn't just Lauren's personal story. It's actually an accounting through one person's eyes of these years, 2004 through 2008. And so we came up with the encapsulation scene memoir because that felt like the most accurate way to describe it. Mm-hmm. But my relationship to the word scene is I think it's a really useful word for all of the reasons that you expressed. But I also think there's a tipping point at which a scene can attract too many people who are interested in proximity to that scene and not the values of their cultural production or the fandom that first brought that group of people together. Mm-hmm. And I think like, in those moments, a fracturing happens and it's kind of like a dying star and new little scenes are formed. But it is funny that like, I think Lauren has doesn't have a completely positive relationship to that word either, but it was still the best word that we could come up with. And we looked at a lot of different versions of this subtitle to encapsulate what this book is. And I think if people have strong reactions to the word scene, that will be a good thing for the book, because that tension is in the book itself.
Yeah. I mean, I remember coming up, in the underground punk, hardcore scene in the mid 90s, pretty much everyone that I knew either took photos, published a zine, was in a band, book shows, had a label. I mean, it was a very, very participatory culture. And Scenester was a very like derogatory term that people would use to describe, I think, maybe their unnamed jealousy of people that maybe had derived a minor amount of clout from actually doing the grunt work that no one appreciates. Like people would be like, oh, that guy, he's like, he does the shows every week. Like, what a scenester. And I was like, man, even, you know, at 17, I was like, this is the dumbest thing to criticize somebody for. It's like nobody's making any money. Like you're always at risk of like the cops coming or a noise violation or just something going wrong. And like, without this, like you don't have anything to do on a Saturday afternoon. So yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that scene gets weird because I think underneath it touches on all these delicate, like, who gets to belong? Mm. Are these my people? Do I feel safe here? Is this my scene? Is this your scene?
Do I feel seen by the scene? Do I?
Well, there's something to me here about like the idea of being a joiner. And when we were talking earlier about like maybe rejecting like jock culture, I feel like when I was a kid, a teen, you know, it's like you think of jock culture as this joiner culture or like, yeah, you know, other things like going to like a study group after school, anything like this, like that's a joiner culture. And mm-hmm. then something like punk culture, maybe in my mind at least, that didn't like that's not joiner culture. But what you're talking about being a scenester, that's being a joiner, like a participant, a doer, right? Rather than just being a spectator. Mm-hmm. But it's in this like it's just like finding like that that's I guess that's just what maybe youth culture is like finding the thing that you're comfortable joining that doesn't feel like you're being a joiner in this pejorative sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think who doesn't want to join an amateur cult at some point? You know, I think it's a lot of fun and it gives you access to friends and new information. And I think maybe most importantly, like an identity that just feels like more easy to be inside of than perhaps the one that you had before, which I think probably up until you're like 10 is just like whatever people tell you, like that's like kind of what you are, you know? And then you start, without going too psychological here, you know, you start individuating. Mm-hmm. You have to do that a lot as a grown up, you know? Yeah. Like you have to individuate out of your, you know, prestige era. You have to individuate out of your 20s. You have to individuate out of, you know, all this other stuff that like sort of gets a little dense and sticky if you don't, you know, burn it down.
Yeah, I like that.
You mentioned Nirvana, but what were some of the other bands that brought you into this world in the 90s?
Ooh, you know, I think I've had to live a lot of my life reconciled to the fact that like I wasn't a Beastie Boy, but they for me were the like the Don Dada archetype of what I wanted to inhabit. Maybe there's the Jewish tri-state area connection, but I think, you know, I got into them like right as Check Your Head was cresting. So on Friday nights, we would go ice skating at the town next to where I lived. It was called Old Bridge and they had an ice skating rink. The ice skating rink only played one CD, which was Van Halen's Greatest Hits, which was very punishing. But, my neighbor, Kenny, he had an older brother who could drive and in the car back and forth every time they just played Check Your Head over and over and over again. And I think for me, like, it was cool to see something that was like popular enough where like other people knew what it was, but also felt like it was mine. Mm. Like there was stuff that was popular, but I didn't feel like, oh, this is my thing. This is like what I'm really into. Like Pearl Jam was never that band for me, you know? But the Beasties both felt kind of like mass and underground at the same time. And so that was a big one for me. And then, I mean, if you want to go, can we get like nerdy?
Of course. Please.
Yeah. So, I mean, like most people, I had to settle for like a mid-90s version of like what I thought was cool. So I had to cycle through like a little bit of like Primus and 311 to get to like the real shit. But in 1996, my friend Ivan got his license, and Ivan was a year older and like really, 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 really cool. For all of you Dime Square kids, he was the, might still be, I think he's the bartender at Clandestino.
I was going to say, where's Ivan now?
Ivan Burko he's become a very successful DJ and music producer, but like Ivan was super cool. Ivan had the Velvet Underground box set. Like Ivan was.
How was he dressing back then?
He was dressing awesome. He was dressing. He was dressing in Ringer tees and sort of shitty, like a little, like not quite baggy, but like not quite fitting Levi's, and probably I'm gonna go with like. We're going to say like some Converse One Stars, which were like hyper Cobain coded at the time, because those were, you know, the famous Cobain shoes. So in around 96, Ivan got me into like very underground hardcore. There was a label called Gravity, which is sort of like the Motown of like hipster screamo music. And that stuff really spoke to me because it was like super fashion forward. All these kids look like they were trying to dress like the Jam in like 1978, but like through like a 90s lens. So it's like really, really tight Levi's polyester pants, the white belt, which later kind of graduated into like the yeah, Strokes indie sleaze look, but started back then. What used to be called like the Spock Rock haircut. So that really severe dyed black bangs look, you know, super tight shirts. And I fell in love with it. I just thought it was the hippest shit. Cause in Jersey, the hardcore scene was very much not that. It was much more like, I'm straight edge, I'm vegan, like you're wrong, blah. You know, and this was more like, I don't know, I felt like it was like the island of misfit toys.
Can we go? So we've been talking about a lot of 90s artifacts. Can we talk about some 2020s artifacts? You're an artifacts enthusiast, self-identified. What are you enthused about right now? Current artifacts.
Ooh, one of my favorite things is this underground fashion zine called Hank's Americana that just put out, I think, their fifth issue. The dude Henry Fisher is his name. Works at Ralph as his day job, but really I think has a interesting kind of like, imagine Grateful Dead parking lot stoner vibes meets like a person who grew up in Texas wearing like Ivy League clothes. So like it's not like me where there was like a class cosplay element. It was more like people around him really wore chinos and loafers and like, you know, salmon pants and that kind of stuff. But I think the styling is terrific. It's funny. It's like sort of like a big subtle fuck you to like everything that I don't like about menswear and I think Henry doesn't like about menswear. So I think that's terrific. I'm a really big fan of The Culture Journalist. I consider a podcast to be an artifact, even though it is technically like it's online.
You can't kick it.
Yeah. If we could find a podcast that kicked, I mean, I would be, if I could just mail someone a podcast, it'd be very.
We're working on the technology, Elliot.
Thank you. Yes. I want to reverse engineer, like, I guess like, zeros and O's into like, I don't know, wood grain and silk.
Yeah.
You know, for actually, for we're doing a partnership. Tasteland's doing a partnership with FIFA. So for the upcoming World Cup, we're preloading our podcast on all the soccer balls.
That's not true. I wish that was true. If they have any money left.
Podcast you can kick.
Well, I've got to get my hands on Hank's Americana because I think my husband would be really into that. I think it strikes me that also a lot of times what's subversive is contextual. And my husband grew up on a prep school campus because his dad was a member of the faculty. Mm-hmm. And so he, of course, you know, went through a period where he was wearing like a drug rug. Because like the most subversive thing you could do in that environment is, you know, run in the other direction of preppy. But if you were in a sort of anti-prep scene, mm-hmm. I think there is a certain type of, I mean, that's why you have punk rockers in polo shirts too.
Oh, yes.
Because it's the opposite of what everyone else is doing.
Yeah. And I think also, again, for me, like style and those sort of artifacts that revolve around like kind of what you're wearing, to me are just like shorthand for your worldview. Mm-hmm. I mean, a part of me really wishes I wasn't this person, but at the risk of sounding a little jerky, I've always decoded people and perhaps assessed the likeliness that we might be friends based on what they were wearing.
Certainly. Can you say more? You were saying that the magazine represented everything, was like a fuck you to everything you hate about menswear. Can you say what some of those things you hate are?
Yeah, let's talk about our hates.
Yeah, well, first off, you know, I'm a former tie designer as well as a two-time recovering men's fashion expert for both Playboy and GQ. So I say this critique from a place of love.
Inside the belly of the beast.
Yes. What do I hate about menswear? Well, I hate that it's very overly studied. I hate the fact that I think the things that bring you attention online in the menswear scene are actually the exact opposite of what I think like actual personal style looks like. Mm. And again, I know that's a little bit of like algorithmic logic that we all know, where it's like the more loud and severe and self-announcing it is, the more likely it is to, you know, track online. But I don't know. This is like so hard for me because I got made fun of and like kind of beaten up a lot for being a kid who was really into clothes and not performing traditional masculinity. So a part of me, like, I love the fact that it's so okay now for guys to be into clothes. I mean, this was not the case when I was like styling and profiling in 1996 or even in 2002 for that matter, you know? So again, it's weird to diss it because overall, I think it's a really healthy thing, but mm-hmm. I mean, look, you know, it's like, I can't help but have just like a visceral, like, ness when like you see someone like unboxing shoes and be like, yeah. Thanks fam. I'm just like, all right, sick. Like, I mean, I get sent free shoes too. So again, how conflicted I am in real time about all
let
this.
Let me paraphrase you back to you. I was listening to you on another podcast before this, and you said something about like, you are much more interested in like what you can notice about a person's clothing from 1 foot away rather than a mile away, which is just saying like, you're more interested in like those subtle details and, you know, maybe bits of quality, like, oh, is this a nice cut? Is this a nice fabric? Rather than, oh, I'm wearing the big, bright, loud shoe or whatever, right?
Yeah. I think also like in culture, you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. And there's a lot of swaths of menswear that I just sat out and mm-hmm. kept doing my thing. Like I never gorped. I never drop crotched. I never norm cored. And I think like, to me that, you know, I'm 45. So like, for me, like I'm interested in like really annoying particular things. Like we had a Minor Genius clothing swap last week where I invited a bunch of us to get together at my friend's apartment. And everyone just brought like a grip of things, and we just sort of played dress up. It was gate kept for short kings, just because we didn't want it to be
it's
like
a practical
that.
Affair.
Correct. Because if you're going to do a swap and you can only invite six people because it's a small apartment, you need the sizing to, you know, to get going. But when I looked at the stuff that I gave away, I was like, you might have become like a crazy person. So I was like, what don't you like? It's like the rise on these pants is like inch and a half too short. It's like, yeah, not working. Or like, I think the pockets, they don't want flaps. They want to be open. So this blazer is like no more. Or like, what about this rugby? It's like, you know, the collar of it is this like flannel material. So it's like, it looks floppy and sloppy. I don't want that. I wish it was a corduroy collar, because then it would lay nicer. I mean, it's slightly embarrassing to admit how much thought I give into all these things. So again, this is why I can't knock the sort of menswear people, because I suffer from the same disease that they do, you know, but yeah. I do think the like,
it's a different mutation.
I don't know. Like, also like, imagine just like being an alien person teleported down, and you looked at like a menswear influencer's content for a day and be like, okay, you had someone on your pod recently who talked about this, like the agony of trying to document. I think that the anecdote was along the lines of like someone walked around for a half hour trying to find a way to document their day. And I was like, imagine an alien comes down. It's like, okay, so you put the camera down on the ledge. You sort of walk out, you do like a half turn. You do like a little shuck to show the draping of the fabric, and your videos. I mean, I don't know. I'm just
trying
find
to remember
it, like,
who that was. Do you remember, Francis? I remember the anecdote.
I believe the person worked at High Snob.
Was it Claire?
I think it could have been Claire.
That was a fun episode.
Knowing when to hold them and when to fold them is really, I think, a great encapsulation of Tasteland. And so I think it's also a perfect place to end. But thank you so much for coming on.
Thank
this
you.
It's a delight.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And great to be here. Do you call your audience the tasters? I was curious. The landlubbers? Who's the...
landlubbers is a new one.
I know. I think tasties is cute.
Taste heads.
Well, tasties, taste testers, you can tell us. We'll see you next week. Ciao.
All right. Thank you.